Welcome to Uncontrolled Substance with your host, Dr. Cosette Lyons-Jones.
Welcome to Uncontrolled Substance with Dr. Cosette. I am Dr. Cosette, and this is episode 22, Am I My Brother's Keeper? We're dealing with mental health in the holidays and advocating for patients to improve health outcomes. This show will have its usual format of the check-in, the waiting room, the examination room, and the checkout or the prescription. But we're going to change it up a little bit today. First, I'd like to say welcome to the studio with me today, my daughter, Lena Jones. Welcome, sweetie.
Hey, still coming to you live from Los Angeles.
So she's trying to be cute like her father, who's at work today, and he will be periodically popping in for future episodes. But today I have my other ride or die, my daughter, Lena Jones. She's here, and I got a, you know, mommy brag moment. She's here from school, from Yale, on winter break.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, doing very well. So proud of her. She has an interest in global health, so she's always in the know on the various topics that we cover here on Uncontrolled Substance. So welcome to the studio, and I appreciate you being here with me today, babe.
Thanks, Mom.
All righty. We have a lot to cover, but I want to briefly touch on the fact that we just had our November elections. And there were many health-related propositions that were on the ballot this time around. Here in California, where we live, we dealt with propositions related to tobacco reform, the constitutional right to an abortion regardless of the trimester, homelessness, and clean air. These are all important ongoing conversations beyond the voting booth that we have covered on this show, actually, many of them in past episodes, and that we will address in future episodes, especially the clean air one. That would be kind of a novel one for this show. I really have an interest in environmental health and environmental health justice.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to touch on that and kind of go into those spaces, because that is disproportionately impacting, the problems in that area is disproportionately impacting Black and brown communities and marginalized communities across the nation.
It's going to be exciting to see California leading the way in clean energy use for cars, not just nationally, but around the world.
Right, right. Absolutely. So it's going to be interesting, but we don't want to be remiss in recapping on two great wins during the election, one of which is Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock, who earned re-election in the once red state of Georgia in the Senate runoff with against challenger Herschel Walker. we'll just leave it like that. And I want to mention a historic win that happened here in Los Angeles, the mayoral election outcome. Now we have new mayor Karen Bass, who is the first woman and the second African-American elected to that office. She has prioritized attacking homelessness, the issue of homelessness in her new role, and has declared homelessness an emergency. We know from past episodes that we talk about the social determinants of health and the context in which you live, work, eat, play, you know, love. All of those things impact the evolution of health in your body and disease in your body. And so the unsheltered and those who are in a situation where they may not have stability in terms of housing or may not have the quality of housing that they should have because of the environment in which their residence is placed, these are things that are important in terms of the social determinants of health and the development of various diseases. And so it'll be very interesting, because when you talk about homelessness, you have to attack poverty, joblessness. You have to attack the mental health crisis that's not only here in LA, but across the nation. So she will have to have multiple perspectives in attacking this, and it'd be interesting to see which angle she takes. And also, we're dealing with what the media has called a triple-demic.
I experienced the triple-demic, actually.
Well, what do you mean you experienced the triple-demic?
Yale's campus was full of the Yale plague, before I left.
Oh, God.
And it was spreading like wildfire. Okay. And they sent us an email about the triple pandemic that was happening, so that we would continue to mask, continue to distance as best we could, given the opportunity. But at this point, everyone is so over the past 2-3 years of being careful which is terrible, but well, you see the responses of that.
Let's backtrack, okay, because I hear you, because you're talking about pandemic fatigue, COVID specifically, but the triple-demic is the
COVID
flu,
and the flu,
COVID and RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. So you typically see that in kids, but we're seeing it in adults as well during this triple-demic that's going on. We anticipate a jump in the numbers after the holidays when everybody's gathering, you know, indoors in poorly ventilated spaces or too many people on top of each other, you know. So we're keeping our eye on that. But hospitals across the United States have been overwhelmed. The combination of a swarm of these respiratory illnesses on top of the staffing shortages and nursing home closures, you know, keep that in mind. All of these have sparked the state of distress visited upon the already overburdened healthcare system. Experts believe the problem will deteriorate further in the coming months, but I would like to remain optimistic and prayerful on my side and just encourage people to, you know, do their due diligence like you were mentioning.
I feel like even though there is that pandemic fatigue, just common courtesy will help to limit the spread of RSV and of the flu, because we know how those feel. We're familiar with how it feels to wake up one morning and know that something's not right.
Right.
And so when that feeling strikes, immediately getting the mask, bringing it with you everywhere you're going. I have an a cappella group. We have to sing to each other. So if somebody's sick, then somebody has to double mask, you right. know, if we're still going to do the concerts that are coming up.
I would take it a step further. Some would needs to stay there behinds in the dorm room.
I mean, ideally, yes, but yeah, it's final season. Sometimes you got to do what you got to do. And
I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that. Anyway, we tend to look beyond our borders to gauge what may happen down the road here in the United States. And the news of late is of the surge in China that's going on. One of our listeners, Tyra Kingsland, in the Maryland area, Upper Marlboro area, asked me a very good question regarding why the numbers are increasing or have increased in China. And what does this mean for us here in the U.S.? The citizens there are being exposed to the same variants as we are. And they have access to the vaccines and testing, all the tools that you need to mitigate spread. The difference is they have this zero tolerance policy in place.
Yes.
And that worked probably too well and kept people from getting natural immunity, meaning they didn't get the infection organically, you know, in the population. So they may have the vaccine, but they don't have that additional layer of protection from natural immunity that we unfortunately or fortunately have here in the United States. So we're in a place where if we see a surge here, it won't be for the same reasons that we're seeing it there in China. And I just kind of want to put that out there, the importance of having multiple layers of protection as far as not just the history that you may already have of having contracted this virus previously, but also the additional layer of getting the booster.
Yeah.
If you didn't, you know, receive the vaccine, you know, before, get the vaccine. If you've gotten it, complete your series and get boosted, because the booster is different, you know, from the previous one. It has not only the original strain, but it also has, it's called bivalent for a reason, because it has the additional two variants of the coronavirus, the subvariants, BA4 and 5. And it also has some protection, level of protection against emerging variants that are out there in the community.
Yeah, and this is where we say thank you to our national and international health institutions and organizations that are tracking the most prominent, most, you know, easily spread variants that are in the international and national communities so that they can make those boosters. There are people who are employed to figure out what booster to give us based on the trends of the virus and how it's evolving.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. My daughter has an interest in global health, so it's kind of give you the backstory of her comment. I am so excited today to have back with us a fan favorite, C. Anderson. She's a licensed therapist, advocate, and author who was on our show previously sharing with us with regards to an area of expertise for her, intimate partner violence. C is here today because it's the holiday season, and the holidays is a mixed bag for many people who often find themselves experiencing more intense emotions of loneliness, anxiety, or depression or even suicidal ideation during this time of the year. Grief symptoms at the recent or not so recent loss of a loved one may intensify around the holidays. We wanted to do something a little different for the, you know, show today. And because we are uncontrolled substance, we can do whatever we want, right? So I invited a fan favorite, C. Anderson. C, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Hey, baby. And I know you have a long CV. Your resume is crazy. Your TED Talk, you know, presenter, you have all these degrees and accolades, and you have a private practice. You know, there's a lot to you. You have depth. but forgive me. I just want to kind of jump into it and be respectful of your time. I know it's the holidays, and you are going from one thing to the other, like many of us. But can we jump right into it and just kind of talk about the recent news about the passing of Stephen Boss, better known as Twitch, from the Ellen DeGeneres show. He's most well known for and So You Can Think You Can Dance. So You Think You Can Dance. I think the other show. He's a dancer, was his gifting and his craft, but he was a DJ on Ellen DeGeneres. I liked him better as a dancer than a DJ, but he was a beautiful spirit, regardless of what area he operated in. And so kind of wanted to talk because so many, you know, it was all over social media. And we'll touch on this and then go to a commercial break and then come back and pick up the conversation for the last couple of topics for you and I to touch on. But can you comment on the fact that people were shocked because there were no red flags seemingly for his situation?
Sure. Just wishing his family condolences. I actually live in Montgomery now, and he was from Montgomery, so the community here is still very sensitive to and reeling from the news of his passing. I didn't realize, but I knew a couple of his family members who have also just really been posting about their love for him and how amazing he was. And recently, they did a feature of him and the previous chairwoman of Alabama State University's theater program, Dr. Tanae Stewart, where he kind of came back and was giving her flowers and thanking her and talked a lot about his experience and feeling different as a child. So I think just if we speak generally about suicide, right, we as a society have a very specific idea about what suicidal people look like, right? What people who intend to end their life by suicide act like, or the things that they say. And as with any phenomena, we know that there are variables, and certainly Twitch's circumstances seem to fall in the category of it being an anomaly, and that there were no outward or overt red flags, like, oh, he didn't post a sad message on his Instagram. Right, less than 24 hours before the incident, we saw video of him where he was dancing and being the Twitch that the public knows him to be. However, we can assume that in his personal life, within his personal circle, that he didn't say or do or reveal anything that could have indicated that suicide was a thought or in the plan for him. So we have to pay very close attention to not expecting suicide to look like what it's been dramatized as, which is giving all my stuff away, telling people or verbalizing that I'm going to end my life, saying I don't want to live. For a lot of people, there is no sign.
Yeah.
You only find out when you are notified that they've been found or you can't get in touch with them. Because a lot of people decide not to be as open about their intention to end their life via suicide.
This is true. I want to kind of throw in there, though, social media. I think a lot of people, this is a teachable moment regarding social media and how people are seeing the best of people's lives being posted, typically. You know, there are some people who are transparent. They may share other things, but for the most part, it's, you know, at that party, at that concert, on your vacation, you know, on that beach. And so we're judging that a person's life is a certain way based on moments that are not the entirety of their existence. Mm-hmm. And who's to say that his close, real, true close contacts, his family, mm-hmm. May have known of different things through the years, but mm-hmm. they did what we all should be doing. They mind their business as far as not putting his business all out there. Right. Mm-hmm. And he dealt with it in whatever way he felt. I'm pontificating. I'm not saying I know this is a fact, but this is something that I have noticed from my own patients, from my own circle of friends, my village, and people who may DM you. And I'm sure you get a million of these, too, as a psychologist, mm-hmm. where people are going through. But you wouldn't know it from looking at their social media page,
because social media is the highlight reel of people's stories, right? People very rarely will post, oh my God, I can't pay my bills today, or oh my God, the weight of the world is heavy on my shoulders, I don't know what to do, right? People right. aren't as open and honest about the inner workings of their life because social media is public and they may not want everybody, you know, in their business. Mm. So social media is, for all intents and purposes, entertainment, right? Singing mm-hmm. and dancing and jokes and funny sayings and maybe some expert tips and advice for the most part. Mm. But the leading cause of death in America is death by suicide.
Yeah.
And so if that's the leading cause, right, there's an attempt every 11 seconds. Mm-hmm. If that is the cause, then we should be singing, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot more indicators from the people that we communicate with.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's put a pin in it there, pick up the conversation in a few moments. We need to pay the bills. We're going to go to a station break on Uncontrolled Substance on the Real Urban Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Uncontrolled Substance.
Now is the time.
From health to wealth to existing in this world, the Real Urban Radio Network knows Black Lives Matter.
Welcome back to Uncontrolled Substance with Dr. Cosette. I have Lena, my daughter, in the studio with me still.
Hello.
And I believe you wanted to ask C a question.
I wanted to comment on how social media can be used for the highlight reel, as Ms. Anderson was telling us just recently. I feel like we also, any signs that somebody might be struggling, like I can't pay the bills, or I am flunking out of whatever school I'm in, or I am like on the verge of losing my job. I feel like those admissions are played for relatability and humor as well. So it can be very mm-hmm. difficult to recognize if somebody is in a desperate state mentally mm-hmm. from what they project out on social media, even if they are, you know, being truthful to an extent.
I agree.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why social media has incorporated the ability to report certain posts because you may be uncertain as to whether what they're saying is detrimental or a red flag or right. they're in need of something, right? Which is a good thing. However, when we talk about the seasonal loneliness or feeling alone, most of those people aren't on social media. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Most of those people don't have the energy and the bandwidth to attempt to connect to people in that way. So what do we do when we may have a neighbor or a family member or a community member who is really struggling, whether it is with loss or loneliness, right? That feeling of disconnect from other people and even disconnect from yourself. What do we do in those moments? That is the thing that we are really not talking about.
Now, have you ever had to notify or do a notification based on a post that you felt some kind of way about, that you may have suspected potential risk to the poster?
I have had to do a notification or wellness check for actually a text message that I received, just because it was very vague, and then the person stopped communicating, right?
Mm.
So I like to err on the side of caution. Right. I would rather call for a wellness check, report a post, et cetera, and that person be okay and maybe be a little mad because somebody came knocking on their door, right? But they're still alive.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. I love it. I love it. That's good. That's a good thing to put out there so that people will know it's better to err on the side of caution than to take that chance. Now, how would do you make holidays after the loss of a loved one? It's challenging for some people, you know. The holidays is not always happy for some people, and they find themselves. And we can talk about this in the context of grief, and then you can also probably extrapolate and expand a little bit in terms of losses other than death, divorce, or loss of a job, or even of a friendship.
And so not only did we lose a dear mutual friend several weeks ago, a week later I lost another dear friend. And so one thing personally that I've learned is that you are never the same, right? You're never the person that you were before the loss. Never again. And so loss of any kind changes reality. It changes your day-to-day. It just changes you.
Right.
And that's okay. That's what the addition and the subtraction of circumstances, people, situations in our lives, that is the result. But specifically the loss of a loved one hits a little differently, right? We can lose a job. We can always find a new job. We can always rebound financially. But when you lose someone that you have come accustomed to having as a part of your life, you have to figure out how to, one, deal with the emotion of the loss, but also what does life look, feel, taste, smell like, sound like with this individual no longer being here in the physical sense.
Right.
And I know we tell people things like, oh, time heals all wounds. No, it doesn't.
Mm-mm.
We tell people, oh, it'll get better or you'll get over it. No, you don't, right? Grief, the loss of a person, has to be incorporated into one's psyche, right? So if you think about maybe loss being a purple glob of clay and you being a brown glob of clay, those things are not separate. The loss becomes a part of you, and you learn how to move forward while healthily incorporating the loss into your life.
That's a great illustration. I like that. We are in the waiting room on Uncontrolled Substance with C. Anderson, national licensed therapist, advocate, and author, and a repeat interviewee, right? Yeah, because you've been on here before. You're going to be on here some more. If you would bless us so.
Of course.
I would say I agree with everything that you said. Let's can we contextualize? And I know I'm going slightly off, but we got some time here.
Sure.
The church. In the church, there's a scripture that people always, you know, post up and say to each other when we have loss, and is that we, meaning believers, don't grieve as the world does. And I can understand, you know, from a mature, you know, Christian perspective, what that the intent of that passage is. But when you say that, there are some people who are not as studied or may not be as mature scripturally, and they take that as a indication that they can't openly express their emotions during this loss. Now, there's a scripture back in Lamentations that says weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And then there's another scripture that talks about comfort being the blessing that a mourner receives, right? So we can go and touch on that to teach up the person who may not know. But can you for a moment maybe speak to the church as far as being able to own their emotions? Because he said to be angry and sin not, which means he created emotions for a reason. You know, you're God's creation. So,
right.
You know, there's, right. You know, you're not supposed to be shameful about having emotions.
Yeah.
Yes. And so the church, not the word.
Yeah.
But the church and those who are tasked with interpreting it sometimes can remove the human side of being in this life. Right.
Mm.
God created us and we are multidimensional, which means that we have a spiritual part of ourselves. We have a physical being, our bodies, and we also have our emotional and psychological self. And I personally don't believe that we should be neglecting any three of those parts. So when we tell someone, you know, oh, I know you're sad and, you know, you're crying right now, but tomorrow, you know, joy is coming, or however we choose to, or the misuse of, well, God doesn't put anything on us that we can't bear, which is not even scriptural, but we're not going to go there right now. It's important for us to remember that healing comes in those three ways, right? So my physical self, my spiritual self, and my mental, emotional self. Mm-hmm. And guess what? If I lose my husband, or I lose my child, or I lose someone that I love, there's nothing you can say to me that is going to comfort or erase that pain at its highest intensity. So sometimes it is better to pray for folks in silence away from them and just be present with them. You don't have to come up with the perfect scripture. You don't have make it a point to talk about, you know, God doesn't make mistakes. I don't want to hear that if I just buried my child.
That's right. That's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that honestly, there's a little self-righteousness when people approach such a sensitive situation with these grand gestures of offering spiritual advice. If I didn't ask you for it, I probably don't want it right now. There. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to just physically be present with someone, whether you're Christian or you feel like God is leading you to lend a word. Use discernment, but also use your common sense. And guess what? Maybe me saying this to this person at this moment isn't the right time.
Mm-hmm. Lena, did you have something?
I think you began to comment upon it because I was going to add to the scripture bank that we are accumulating here. because recently a friend encouraged me, because I was in a prayer family meeting with this group that I'm in. And we were talking about how our semesters had been, recent occurrences, and I said that I had something kind of sad to share, and I was hesitating to share it. And they were saying, no, recently they had read a scripture, which was in Romans 12, rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. So they were open to that. And they didn't, you know, necessarily say that so it forced me to say anything, but just to know that I was in a space where that was open, and that I could share if I wanted to without any condemnation. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask, because after hearing that, I started to seriously think, how do you rejoice with those who rejoice? How do you specifically mourn with those who mourn in a way that's effective? And you just commented on that a bit, with sometimes you just sit in silence with them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just pray for them, you know, outside of being in direct contact with them. Maybe they aren't asking you for anything, so you don't give them anything verbal.
Yeah.
But spiritually, you're with them.
Right. So maybe that looks like, hey, I didn't want to disturb you. I had a meal dropped at your door, right? So they don't have to worry about cooking. Or maybe that looks like it's a text. Hey, you don't have to respond. Just know I'm thinking of you.
Right.
And if you need me to do this thing for you, or pick your kids up, or, you know, be helpful in that way, the things that really matter. And also I want to bring up, when someone else is struggling or someone else is mourning and they are feeling down, it is not okay to try to censor their emoting.
Yes. Excellent point.
So that means if I am wailing and sobbing, or I am down and crying, I didn't ask you to bring me a ray of sunshine. Maybe I just want you to sit on this cloud with me for a few minutes. I didn't ask you to hug me and shush me, or tell me it'll be okay. Maybe I just need to feel so I can deal and begin my journey to heal.
All righty. You've said and dropped so many nuggets today. Thank you so much, C.
You're
Candace,
welcome.
For coming on. Bless you, beautiful. Keep on soaring.
I'm
rooting on the sidelines. You know I am.
I know you are. I so appreciate and love you.
I love you too, sweetie. Happy holidays to you and your family. God bless.
Same to you all. Bye now.
Thank you. So we are going to pay the bills. We have our second guest, Dr. Nanochka Chumley, another author. So we have these authors on today, but she's going to hit it from another patient empowerment or individual empowerment perspective in terms of the topic of advocacy, advocating for patients to improve health outcomes. It's the topic on Am I My Brother's Keeper, episode 22 of Uncontrolled Substance with Dr. Cosette on the Real Urban Radio Network.
They play my favorite music.
Today's R&B and old school. The Real Urban Radio Network.
It plays what I like.
Now we're in the examination room with our special guest, my friend, Dr. Nanochka Chumley. Our topic today is advocating for patients to improve health outcomes. Dr. Chumley is a physician and author of The Best Patient Advocate. She is a DO and MPH, meaning she has gone to College of Osteopathic Medicine, and she has a master's in public health. So she is a learned individual, highly educated. She's a sweetheart. She has 25 years of experience as a medical consultant, homeopathic practitioner, as well as a healthcare advocate. She is based here in Los Angeles, does family medicine, and is an urgent care physician. Dr. Chumley was the first DO, or osteopathic medicine-trained physician, who was appointed president of the Association of Black Women Physicians. She has worn many hats in that organization, which I am currently the president or outgoing president of, and she is currently on the board with me as our historian. So Dr. Chumley brings many lenses, and I'm excited to be able to share some nuggets from her book. But before we bring in Dr. Chumley for the conversation, kind of wanted to touch on this topic of why Black, indigent, and people of color need patient advocates. You know, so we could just lay it out there.
Definitely.
And we know, and we've talked about it on most of our shows, that the American healthcare system has a legacy, a long history of racism and discrimination. So it's embedded in the structures and the systems, you know, of healthcare. And that makes for an uneven playing field in terms of access, in terms of outcomes, and it impacts and causes the widening of the health care disparities that we have. So even if you were to standardize across education-wise, everybody has the same level of education, everyone has the same economic, socioeconomic level, at the end of the day, race and racism is still factoring in the poorer outcomes that we're seeing among Black and brown people. And so this is an important conversation, because oftentimes we find ourselves at the mercy of the healthcare system, you know, in some instances, because we don't understand the information that's being presented to us, our rights, you know, as patients, where we can go to get additional support as we try to understand what's happening to us as we put ourselves in this vulnerable position as patients.
Yeah.
And so that's something that is near and dear to my heart, as I consider myself as a primary care physician to be the advocate for my patients. And I've always viewed myself through that lens throughout my career, and have found myself even arguing with colleagues, you know, about the care, you know, specialty care of my patients, if I don't understand why they didn't go the extra mile, or why they went in a certain direction, which may not be considered evidence-based or the standard of care.
Yeah.
So that's why it's important to have this conversation with Dr. Chumley today. So I'm so glad that she's on, and that she has this book for people to go and reference beyond this conversation to be able to get more information.
Yeah, it's everything from physical treatment in the exam room and outside, from experimenting on Black and brown bodies for the treatments that we hold so dear today. You know, to get to those treatments, you have to go through a lot of failed medical experiments, and a lot of those have taken place on our own bodies, so physically, but everything from that to the psychological impact of racism, which has suggests to some practitioners that we have a higher pain tolerance.
Yeah.
That the times that we're actually describing some level of pain, that we are overblowing what we actually feel, mm-hmm. wherein they would take perhaps a white patient's symptoms more seriously. It's so embedded that you can't even recognize it sometimes. On the first glance, it seems like a procedural thing, when in fact there are psychological beliefs associated with our race that are undergirding some of these medical decisions.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You talk that talk. That's my daughter. I love it. So I'd like to welcome into the examination room Dr. Nanachka Chumley. Welcome. Welcome, Dr. Chumley.
Thank you so much, and what a way to kick off this conversation. What you have both said is beyond real and beyond correct. So I'm so glad that there's a place and a space for us to talk about things like this. So thank you so much for inviting me. I will say I'm a little nervous, so bear with me, but I'm just excited to be on the show. I'm excited. You're the first person to interview me about my book, so I'm super excited about that.
Oh. That's special. You know, you picked a great topic for your first book out. I remember when you first mentioned to me a desire to write a book, and I don't believe I was privy at the time as to the topics that you were considering, but the final topic choice is spot on. So congratulations on being a published author. I want to jump right into the conversation as far as pulling out of you some of the nuggets that I know is in you. I love how your book describes what a patient advocate is broadly, and then more specifically according to the needs of the patient. What are the advantages to having a doctor take on the role of patient advocate?
That is a great question, and you said it in the intro. I, like you, thought and still feel and believe that the physician is the best patient advocate or the best advocate for the patient. And I remember a few years ago, I actually went back to my medical school, Western University of Health Sciences, which used to be the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific. Mm. And they asked if there were any doctors in the audience and if we wanted to say our oath again. And I thought, I don't need to do that. And I thought, why not? Opened the book, raised my hand, took the oath. And through tears, I was so happy to see in there that it said that we were the patient's advocate. And I didn't recall that from 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I'm so happy to know that it's in our oath. And that because we are a physician, we have the medical knowledge about the disease or the dis-ease or the crisis that the patient is going through. And it's the primary care physician like yourself and I that actually request the authorizations for specialty care for our patients. So we're advocating just by doing that. And I don't consider it a job, or I don't consider it anything extra. I consider that's something that we're supposed to do and
right,
we should do.
Right.
But there are not a lot of people. I really, like you mentioned with some of our colleagues, I would like to believe that all primary care physicians, black women in particular, black physicians in particular, go above and beyond for our patients because that's just what we do. It's natural. It's ingrained in our mm-hmm. DNA. We don't have to take any special class or mm-hmm. anything like that. We're considered the gatekeepers, at least we used to. I always say I'm old and I'm old school. That's what they used to say about us primary care, family medicine physicians. And because we know the back office, the front office, we have colleagues that are consults, so we can just pick up the phone and call, whereas a patient can't do that on their own. I think we're empathetic by nature. We care by nature. I don't think that everyone has that empathy or that caring nature. I think it's a God-given gift. I consider it a gift. I would like to believe that we all have it. I don't think that we all do. And for those of us who do have it, I think we use it naturally. It just comes naturally to us to be empathetic and to care. And we've also, over time, developed a doctor-patient relationship with that patient. So the patient trusts us, especially if they're a black woman. And they see, I've had patients tell me, I heard them whisper in their cell phone, oh, my doctor just came in the room and she's black. So they're happier. There's a trust factor over time that you develop with the patient, that you still have that doctor-patient relationship, which I think helps. So when we pick up the phone and call to ask a question or to advocate for the patient, I'm hoping that on the other end, because we are physicians, that they'll go the extra mile or do something that they should do anyway. But because we're calling as a patient's physician, and they trust that, you know, we have our best, the patient's best interest at heart, then they'll go the extra mile as well and maybe make sure that a space opens up on the schedule for a patient to get in an urgent, emergent type of situation, and we don't have to send them to the emergency room because we were able to pick up the phone and advocate for them.
So,
and also,
let's look at it from a different perspective. What's the difference between how you advocate for your friends and family members versus how you advocate for your clinic patients?
You know, for me, it's the same. However, when it's a family or friend, I think you just push. I push 110 for patients. I think I pushed 150 for friends and family. But for me, I treat the patient as if they were family because that's somebody's mother or aunt, brother, sister, uncle, father. So I don't take it lightly. I treat the same, but I even push harder when it's a friend, a family member or a friend. And again, because you're a friend or family member and happen to be a physician, you can pick up the phone and call and intervene for your family member or for a friend, and hopefully things move a little bit faster.
Now, you know, the lines can become blurred between the role of a caregiver and of a patient advocate if it's a family member or close friend, right? Can you tell us why a caregiver is not a patient advocate automatically? I mean, they can be, but it's not automatic that because you're the caregiver that you're the best patient advocate.
Absolutely. The way I see it and the way I saw it even before I was a physician is that usually a caregiver is a family member or a friend, like you said, and they usually feel indebted to that person for whatever reason. It may be someone's mother or someone's aunt, and they may feel like they owe it to that person. They usually are not trained in any, you know, they don't have a certificate. They don't go to school to be a caregiver. They usually just love and care about that person. They provide activities of daily living. They may cook for the person who's unable to cook for themselves. They may clean the house because the patient's not able or the family member's not able to, you know, clean for themselves. They may drive them to their doctor's appointment because the patient, you know, may not be able to drive. And things like that. And they could, like you said, be the patient advocate, but they wouldn't be the, I wouldn't think they would be the best patient advocate. The best patient advocate, and I shouldn't say it, but in my humble opinion, is the physician. But it doesn't have to be. But because we have the medical knowledge, we have the education, we're able to, you know, we have that patient relationship. The goal, the number one goal for, to me, as a patient advocate, is someone who represents the best interest of the patient in any medical situation. Someone who has a heart for people, who's empathetic and want to lock arms with the patient and fight for the best possible outcome.
For the non-physician, looking at non-physicians, what type of person would, in your opinion, would make a good patient advocate?
Someone who has a heart for people, someone who wants to help, someone who is able to listen to the patient's concerns and make sure that they're addressed, someone who's not afraid to ask the hard questions, someone who's aggressive and assertive, keeps the patient's wishes and concerns up front and helps them carry, supports them and helps them carry it out.
Excellent. Let's take a moment to look at bad news, receiving bad news from the doctor. It's always hard. It's never easy to give the information. It's never easy to receive it. So it's uncomfortable on both sides. Some people do better than others in delivering that information. And some people do better than others in actually receiving and processing that information. I like how your book goes into that space to talk about, you know, to provide the reader with some tools to be able to advocate still in the midst of receiving bad news. So receiving bad news from your doctor can be a trigger. It can trigger all sorts of emotions. It can make hearing and understanding and the information and making health decisions difficult, right? Can you take our listeners through the five emotional stages of a healthcare crisis that you mentioned in your book?
For me, it's gotten a little easier over time, but like you said, it's never easy giving bad news. But I think our words are so important, and I think how we deliver the bad news and how you say the bad news makes a huge difference. But there are five normal, I want to make this really clear, these are normal reactions, because I think sometimes when a patient or a person's given bad news or uncomfortable news, they don't think or feel that these different stages are normal. So I want to make it really clear that they're very normal. And there's five stages. The first one is denial, which I think we all can understand. Someone tells you bad news, you just don't believe it. You just cannot believe what they are telling you. But denial is actually a protective mechanism that usually tries to provide a cushion to soften the emotional blow and to help sort of rationalize the information you were given. Mm-hmm. So it's normal to be in denial, to say, what did they say I had? I don't have that. And then the next step is, none of these are, you can stay in any one of these stages for an insignificant amount of time. And there's no right amount of time or wrong amount of time. Mm-hmm. You just have to sit in each one for as long as you need to before you move on. And you can go back and forth so that it can oscillate. The next is anger. I would be angry, too, if somebody gave me some horrible information. So it's normal to feel angry.
Right.
I want to make sure that the patient, you never want to blame the patient, because sometimes the patient will feel it's their fault, even though it's not any fault of their own that they may have gotten metastatic breast cancer, for example. But it's very, very common to be angry and upset. But once the numbness wears off, it becomes the stage where I call it accepting the unacceptable. And it's also a stage where you have to be careful, because sometimes when people get upset or they get angry, their emotions get out of control, they get frustrated, even embarrassed. And I thought, when a patient told me that one time, I thought, how could you be embarrassed about a disease that you didn't cause?
Right.
But that's part of it. So they need to understand and know that that's normal, it's okay. And sometimes in this stage, it's the stage where patients may eat too much. Eat, not a bowl of ice cream, but the whole carton of ice cream. Mm. They may use drugs, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Whether they're prescribed drugs or drugs you can buy over the counter, like alcohol. As you have stated earlier, there's so much racial injustice and microaggressions. They need to know that they're real and that they affect Black people in general. Mm-hmm. More devastatingly than others, and Black women in particular, specifically. Again, it's normal. You hate to say being normal is being angry and in denial is normal, but it is.
So what's again, the B? B in your DABDA acronym?
Yes, that's what I'm going through, actually. DABDA is denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and I'm just doing them one by one. I did D. The first D was denial. The A is anger. The next letter, B, is bargaining, and that's the third stage. And again, you can oscillate in between. That it doesn't have to go in order.
Right.
And in the bargaining stage, it's a line of defense against emotions of grief. We play the what if game. What if I had gone to the doctor earlier? What if I had that breast reduction 20 years ago before I actually got breast cancer? Would that have, would they have found the cancer earlier? Would I even have cancer at all? In the bargaining stage, you kind of postpone confusion and sadness and hurt. But it's a line of defense that deals with grief. And it's a time, again, to realize it's normal. And that person has to sit in that stage for as long as they need to sit in that stage. And I think that's what's so important about all these stages, is just letting the person know that they are normal and what they're going through is normal, and to listen. You don't have to necessarily do anything, just listen. The next acronym, or the next letter in the acronym, is D for depression, the fourth stage. And again, we don't necessarily move in all these stages one by one. We can go back and forth. But I think we need to realize that it's also real and that it's present, and that you can be depressed because you were given this horrible news.
Right.
But it's considered normal. You just don't want to stay there. The standard in family medicine and in medicine, they say if it's over a year, then we need to worry about it. So that's giving people a long time to know that they can actually be depressed and grieve and be pissed off and angry, in particular depression, for 1 year. That's not considered abnormal, and you don't necessarily have to be put on medication because you're grieving or you're depressed because they've given you this life-threatening information or bad news. Usually in this stage, the patient will feel like they're going to be in this stage forever. But it's not. It's not. A year is considered okay. You're not considered mentally ill because you're depressed, for a year because of what you've been going through. It's appropriate. And so I think patients just need to know that they just need words of encouragement so they don't feel like they're not normal. All this is normal. And the last stage is acceptance, which is which is the last acronym, or A in the DABDA.
Right.
And that's acceptance. And I think this, for me, is probably the hardest stage, because it's the stage where you have to have made the decision to accept the unacceptable, and that the reality of the crisis, you own it at that point.
Yeah.
But to me, it's a stage where you fight and you reorganize to live, because you're not dead yet. You're still here.
Right.
You may have gotten bad news, but you're still here. So you know you're gonna have more good days than bad days. So let's make the best of your time that's left, as opposed to giving up at that point. That's the time when they put on your boxing gloves and do the Muhammad Ali rope-a-dope.
That's right. That's a good place to pause for a station break, and we'll come right back in to our final segment, the checkout. And you're going to hold on the line for a moment, Dr. Chumley. We'll be right back,
yes,
okay?
Yes.
All right, we'll be back on Uncontrolled Substance on the Real Urban Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Make a difference. At the Real Urban Radio Network, we know who we are, and we make no excuses about it.
You gotta know where you came from to know where you're going, you know?
Welcome back to Uncontrolled Substance with Dr. Cosette. My lovely daughter is in the studio with me still, just soaking up all this great information.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. and we have our special guest that we're going to take right into the next segment, the checkout or the prescription. Dr. Nanochka Chumley, welcome back.
Thank you.
All righty. So we were talking about the stages when a person is presented with bad news, right? The five emotional stages that they may vacillate, you know, through when they're presented with bad news. I know this is something that we can extrapolate to other areas, and we've seen this in other fields and usages. So I appreciate that you contextualize it in this setting so that you can normalize the emotions that may erupt in a person when they're presented with information from their doctor that they may not appreciate or like. How can a patient advocate support an individual during these stages after they received unwanted news or an unwanted diagnosis?
I think I mentioned it earlier. I'll just say two words: be present. Listen and reflect the stages and validate their feelings and explain to them the different stages, if they're able to even absorb, and let them sit in it until they're ready to move forward. And just be supportive, hug them, and just speak, you know, positive words, positive affirmations over their life. Don't have anything negative to say.
What I love about this is that you didn't hear the interview with our other guests, but that actually was a theme in the discussion that we had with her with regards to people who are depressed or people who are grieving in particular. Mm-hmm. And we always feel obligated to say something. We got to say something. Got to give a scripture. We got to do something that like gets the panacea for the remedy of the situation. And it's not. Oftentimes, we just need you to be present and just, you know, show your love in silence.
Just be there. Just be there. Just be in the same room with them.
Yeah. So I love that it connects. Mina?
Yeah. It's important not to rush the process of grief, right?
Yeah,
leave some things, some stones unturned.
And not to rush the process of processing the information that you're presented with by a doctor.
Yeah.
There's a balancing act there too, though, because there are some instances where they do need to kind of process it quickly in terms of making decisions.
For effective decision making.
Right. Because
and that's where the patient advocate would come in, to be able to answer their questions and help them navigate and understand, quote unquote, quickly in layman terms, but letting them know that, you know, a decision has to be made. But that's why I just don't know how you cannot have a patient advocate when you've been given devastating news.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a health toolbox in your book. What is the health toolbox that every patient should have when accessing healthcare?
You know, that was, I think I used that term loosely. So for me in health, if it say, for example, you have something simple, if you will, a diagnosis of, let's say, diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in your health toolkit, you want to make sure you have your diagnosis list, a list of your medications, an EpiPen if you have serious, you know, if you have allergies, your glucometer, a blood pressure cuff, your advance directive for your health care, because sometimes we tell our families and friends verbally, oh, you know, I don't want to be coded if I should go in the hospital, and this verbal is not written down anywhere.
Right.
And then someone will end up not doing something to you that you don't want having done. So your code status should be in that toolbox, emergency phone numbers for people to call. And I know people don't like, you know, these the jewelry that has your diagnosis on it, but I think it's invaluable, and they make them, they bling them out now, so they're that boring.
Yeah,
I think you need to have that on your arm if you have high blood pressure,
they have
or diabetes,
anklets.
COPD.
Yeah,
they're cute.
They have the anklets.
They're cute now.
Yeah, they're cute
for the women out there who want a little bling in their life.
Right,
it's available.
Right.
What else? If you know that you use drugs, so you should have Narcan in there. I mean, some of the stuff sounds simple. But not if you're an asthmatic. You want your rescue inhaler in there. You want your phone, extra phone charger, water and snacks if you're a diabetic. Again, you want to have whatever your affirmations, your Bible, your insurance card. You may even want to have your life insurance and your, you know, estate planning all together in case of emergency. Grab that toolbox and go straight to the ER if you have to.
Those are all great points and suggestions. I would also add a notebook and pen. So that you write things down. One of the things that's kind of a pet peeve of mine is when I see a patient just sitting there and they're like, yes, yes. And I'm like, I know they're not retaining all of this information. This
exactly.
is too much, and it's overwhelming me to even present it to you. So I know it has to be overwhelming to the person that may not completely comprehend what's happening. So I think having a pen and paper and writing down basic information before you go that appointment, as far as your questions and concerns and things that you want to make sure that the doctor hits, because the agenda of the physician is not always the agenda of the patient. And the patient is coming in with a whole different, you know, line of questions and concerns that may not be answered by the physician that they're in front of, because they don't know that that's their concern. So to do your top three, because you get 15 to 20 minutes.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I tell all patients, don't have a laundry list. If you have a laundry list, put the top three at the top, and then bring the list with you every appointment, and we'll try to get through each one by one. We don't have enough time to effectively address 10
items. Yeah, absolutely.
It's impossible. You're gonna miss something. That's what I tell. I said, don't get upset. We have to stay focused, because I don't want to miss the skin cancer because I didn't look at your skin because you start talking about your toe.
And so
you got to stay focused so that we don't miss something and end up later.
Absolutely.
Or as I said, in one of the places I worked, the person was fully clothed with their crossbody bag on, a scarf and a hat, and they were ready for their physical. I said, by who? Not by me.
Yeah.
And they would say things like, other doctors do it. I said, well, I'm not that other doctor. I need you to be undressed and in a gown. That's how I do it.
Ooh, you're hitting on a whole nother conversation. We may have to bring you back.
I just had to throw that in there because it happens so often. It still amazes me that.
But what I like is the fact that when they bring in a notebook, it's not just the notebook of the things that they thought about before the appointment, but it's a notebook that's supposed to be used during the appointment to write down their test results, their blood pressure that day, their weight that day, things that they're tracking, their blood sugar or whatever. So that notebook is powerful, so that it's like your peripheral brain, where you won't have to remember everything off the top of your head, the dates and times and doctors, especially if you have multiple conditions or you're seeing multiple specialists or you have a workup in progress. It's hard to keep it all straight. And you have this notebook that's a gift that keeps on giving because you could just refer to it. I want to bring that up. I think, Lena, did you want to comment?
Just as a final question, just an affirmation, using that notebook at the end of the appointment to have the physician restate their most important points that they gave you, would that be helpful for the patient? Because sometimes you don't even know what to write down. I'm thinking about like lectures in college. Sometimes you don't even know which stuff is going to be on the test. Sometimes you don't even know which stuff is going to be a immediate health issue or a long-term health issue, you know, like where the decision making will come into play, like quickly, or if it's a consistency thing. So just at the end of the appointment, asking the physician, can you give me a rundown of the most important things I should focus on right now? You know,
those are excellent points, Lena. Thank you. I would like to run a list. And Dr. Chumley, chime in, you know, either be the hallelujah amen choir on it, or mm-hmm. or add a different lens or perspective. I wanted to kind of talk about some highlights, because there's things that can be done in terms of advocacy. Advocacy can come from different directions, as you mentioned. It could, you're the best patient advocate is about the physician taking on that role, but it also gives nuggets and information to empower individuals, family members, friends, the patient themselves, to be a better advocate for themselves, so that mm-hmm. They can navigate that space more effectively. But there's also things that can be done at the level of the institution, you know, when you're talking about the healthcare system in general. So institutions can support patient advocacy by revolutionizing healthcare delivery by incorporating patient advocates throughout the patient journey and actively supporting their presence, like doulas and friends and family members joining in on the appointments. I'm reading all kinds of stuff on the internet, but I think I saw someone put that. It might have been Tia that had that on their site, but I think it was worth mentioning here, because, you know, patient advocacy isn't just an office or a job title given to one individual.
Right. Definitely.
It's something that can be embedded throughout, you know, the process, the system, so that where it may fail in one area, someone else may be successful in the other area when the patient comes in contact with them.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
All righty. Providers can advocate for their patients by empowering them through teaching and shared decision making. I'm really huge on shared decision making, because you get buy-in with motivational interviewing when you know the story behind, you know, what's going on, the context within which the health evolved of that individual, talking about the social mm-hmm. determinants of health that we talk about on the show, you know, almost every time we come on the air, you know, what they eat, the air they breathe, what they drink in terms of the water, where they work, mm-hmm. where they sleep, if they're sheltered, unsheltered, the problems that are hopefully going to be successfully tackled by our incoming mayor, Karen Bass. You know, so these are things that I think is important in shared decision making. You get buy-in and you're more likely to get compliance or adherence to a care plan mm-hmm. when the patient understands it to the point that they can make a decision in collaboration with the physician, as opposed to being dictated to with information that they may not fully comprehend.
And that is my whole point, getting a patient advocate on board immediately, because we will be able to help them in that shared thinking and shared communication that they need earlier, versus when they're halfway through the program or they're halfway through the process. They need it sooner rather than later, so that we can assist them to do everything you just said.
Absolutely.
So it has to be done early.
Yes, yes.
So for me, as soon as the diagnosis or the bad news is given, it's not 6 months later that you pull in the advocate. It's at that moment.
And one thing that's also important is that it continues beyond the appointment. So,
absolutely. So it's definitely beyond the appointment.
When we leverage our support staff, like our health educators, the navigators, our licensed clinical social workers, patient liaison representative, all of these people can contribute to creating an environment in which you can ensure that the care continues beyond the appointment, and that you get buy-in for follow-ups and lifestyle changes. Now, at the level of the patient, patient's rights are important, and knowing your patient's rights or the patient's bill of rights. Now, I want to mention this, because we get all these papers when we go to the office, you know, that you that you sign, and most of the time you don't read it, right? Patients don't read it.
Right.
They just sign it and throw it back, right?
Exactly.
Right.
But one of those documents is the patient's bill of rights, and it includes information to empower the patient to know that the things that they have a right to know, you know, to have access, you know, to, and all that. So I think it's important that you read your paperwork and that you know your rights as a patient, just in case something happens that you question, should this have happened to me? And what are my rights now that this has happened?
Mm-hmm. Even just knowing that the title Patient's Bill of Rights exists is important because even if you don't remember after you read the whole thing, the specific ones, you can go back and Google it really easily. I'm sure it's out there floating.
Right. And so I know that California Department of State Hospitals, they post mm-hmm. their patients' rights. And one is yes. a right to dignity, privacy, and yes. humane care. Number yes. one, right? Mm. A right to be free from harm, including unnecessary yeah. or excessive physical restraint, isolation, mm-hmm. medication, mm-hmm. abuse, or neglect. Medication shall not be used as a punishment for the convenience right. of staff, as a substitute for a program, or in quantities that interfere with the treatment program. Right to prompt medical care and treatment. Not delays of care. Not, you may have cancer, but you can wait 6 months before you get that specialist yeah. appointment. You know, there's been issues with referrals within county, in particular, with long wait times. And it seems to probably be something that's going to be exacerbated across the healthcare systems as we see more doctors exiting the profession from burnout. Mm. You know, just fatigued and totally wiped out from this pandemic. A lot of people are exiting. Some people don't like how it's evolving. The technology right. heavier side of medicine that we have to operate in is a turnoff for some people, and they say enough is enough. So there's many reasons why people are exiting the profession. And so we want to keep that in mind. A right to religious freedom and practice is yeah. actually contained in a healthcare patient's bill of rights.
That makes sense.
You know, think about the Jehovah's Witnesses. I don't want blood transfusion if I'm right. a Jehovah's Witness, right? And we have to respect that and be able to equip them with the information for the alternatives and know yeah. how to tap in and access, exactly. you know, those alternative blood products, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. those are some things.
I want to chime in because this is such a big issue, and I think this is sort of a joke, but seriously, I've been telling patients, I said, I think I'm going to have a side business where you pay me something like $35, something that somebody can afford, and I'm going to go over the Bill of Rights, everything that you're signing, and tell you in plain English what it says in key point, because they don't know. And what I keep telling patients, you guys have more power than I do, believe it or not. I said, you're the patient. It's your insurance company. Pick up the phone, call that customer service number, and ask to speak to someone in charge. Yes. You have power by just being a member with that insurance company. They're responsible. So if you don't know what you're reading and writing, I'm going to be there. I already do it as part of my patient advocacy, but it's at the point where I think it needs to be one person at each facility or at each clinic, at each hospital, at each private practice that goes over the paperwork with the patient, spending maybe 15 minutes going over everything you just said, one-liners, pointers. So that when they sign, they feel confident, like, okay, I may not know every single solitary thing on here in detail, but I've just been told it by a professional that cares about me and that's not going to be leading me down the wrong path. That is so important.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I like that. So thank you so much, Dr. Chumley, for coming on the show. This was excellent. We will continue this conversation. I probably will circle back even in January to talk about some additional things that will help to improve health literacy, help to empower our listeners to be better advocates for themselves. Ultimately, yeah. I'm praying that advocacy is embedded throughout the process, and that we see ourselves as physicians, myself being a physician, you're a physician, and our other peers and colleagues that may be listening to the show, that we will look at our role a little differently if you're not already actively engaged as an advocate for your patient as a result of the conversation that we had today. But also, finally, empowering the village, you know, empowering, yeah. you know, our patients to take a yeah. family member, you know, to the appointment with them, to not go alone so that you can have two brains, you know, two heads yeah. hearing the information.
Yeah.
Not ending an appointment until they feel that they understood everything that the provider said to them. To research before they go and to ask all the questions that they want to. There's no stupid question, you know?
Exactly.
The only stupid question is the one that's not asked.
Absolutely.
In the context of a patient-doctor relationship. So thank you so much for this important conversation. Your book, The Best Patient Advocate. I would encourage people to go on Amazon, take a look at that, and get more information.
And if they're local in the Los Angeles area, my book is at Malik's Bookstore in the old Fox Hills Mall, now called Westfield, next to See's Candy.
Thank you.
And if you want more information, it's thebestpatientadvocate.info. And thank you so much for having me.
Oh, awesome. Thank you for coming on. We enjoyed you. And that's our show for the month of December 2022. This is one that we probably would replay because this information won't get old. You know, the topics that were presented today is something that will still be relevant a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. So I thank C. Anderson for coming on the show again. We'll definitely have her back in the examination room on future shows. And we thank Dr. Chumley as well for enlightening us in this area of advocacy for our patients. This is the end of the year. You made it.
Yeah.
It may have been hell. Yeah. It may have been rough. It may not have been pretty. You may have not been shiny and new at the end of the struggle, but you're still here.
That's right.
I say, God bless you. Be strong. Continue on. We're going to do this together. And it takes all of us collectively to hold each other up. So check in on your friends. Yeah. Check in on the ones that you think are strong. To check in on the ones that you may not think are as strong. You'll be surprised who really is going through and who is doing just fine. But you don't know unless you ask. So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year's, Happy Kwanzaa, you know, all those holidays that we're celebrating now. I appreciate you, Lena, for being on the show with me today and chiming in.
Thank you for having me. It's always a joy to see the things that I'm learning about in an academic setting have actual real-world application.
Absolutely. So thank you. And thank you, our listeners on Uncontrolled Substance. We say thank you. This is it. You made it. And I am so proud of you all. I thank you for taking time out to listen, to support Uncontrolled Substance on the Real Urban Radio Network. And I invite you to come back on the fourth Sunday of every month, starting in the new year, 2023. Can you believe it? I know. Oh, 2023 is crazy. Thank you. God bless.